Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Adam Nitti. And yes, it has been a minute, but the wait will be worth it because today we have the incredible guitarist Mark Letary with us, and you're going to really enjoy this episode. So, Mark, thank you so much for being here. And man, it's been, first of all, it's been so awesome to get to play with you now more than just a couple times. And yeah, it's always really an honor for me to be able to speak to people like yourself, whose craft I respect so immensely, and had a chance to experience it on stage and even in the recording studio as well. I'm excited to kind of dig in because I want to learn more about the myth behind the man when it comes to what you're doing. So, man, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, yeah, of course, man. Glad we finally found a day that worked.
Yeah, like, man. What I want to start out with, the thing that I love so much about your playing, and I don't know, a little background for the audience. One of the reasons I have such an affinity for Mark is, first of all, we're Italian brothers.
I was going to say, it's because we are both Italian American, yeah. And that's where it ends.
Yes. Yeah. And that's like blood, you know, so that's, right. That's very important to clear up. But also too, we're at least roughly of the same generation. And what's interesting is that some of the influences that I've had from, let's say, the 80s, I was surprised to kind of hear rear its head in some of our conversations and even in some of your music. And although I can't remember the exact year that Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears came out.
86?
It was mid-80s. I don't remember the exact year.
85, I think.
Okay, cool.
Maybe, I don't know.
The first time that I played with you was at City Winery. And that was one of the songs that was on the set. And I remember being so impressed because I didn't know you that well. But what you did with that song and sort of in crafting this guitar landscape with what was obviously a really strong melody already was so awesome. And I just wanted, if you don't mind, I'd like you to talk about, and you can use that song as an example, but how you've sort of threaded those influences from, let's say, the pop world, you know, for lack of a better description, into your playing, because it's something that I think makes you really unique.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, that song has been a favorite of mine since I was a kid. I grew up, part of my youth was in Europe, actually, when I was really little, like 3 to 5. And I vaguely remember that song. So this would have been the late 80s. And so I vaguely remember that song being either on the radio or maybe like on the TV or something at the time. And then I kind of like reconnected with it, watching that Val Kilmer film, Real Genius.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that years ago or something. And I was like, man, that song, I just still really love that. It's just an incredibly written, produced, performed. It's just like, it's like a perfect pop song.
It really is. You know?
And I had been playing it in my live show for a while with my band, both as a trio and then sometimes with keyboards. And then when I was doing that record, Spark and Echo, we had some extra time in the studio and I was there with JT and Wes and I was like, hey, you guys want to do Everybody Wants to Rule the World real quick? And they're like, yeah, sure. So I kind of like wrote out the form a little bit because I wanted it to stick pretty much to the original form. We lengthened the kind of the solos a little bit, but other than that, it's the same. And so we recorded it as a trio and then I was like, what am I going to do with this? And earlier, I was trying to think, several, maybe like 6 or so months earlier, I had played it on the first tour I ever did under my own name. And I had invited a friend. We were playing in Atlanta and I just had a wild hair. I was like, man, I want to get pedal steel on this and see what happens. And I had a friend in Atlanta named William Barnes, who's a fantastic guitar player and pedal steel guy. And I was going to call him to sit in anyway. And I was like, do you know Everybody Wants to Rule the World? I don't know. It might be cool if you like played the keyboards on the pedal steel, you know, and he was like, I kind of know it, you know, so we played through it and it had a nice texture and that always kind of stuck with me. So when we were fast forward to doing the Spark and Echo sessions, we had that extra time with the trio and we recorded the rhythm tracks. And then I called this steel player in town, Milo Deering, who is just like a virtuoso on anything with strings. And so I called him in. He's a local guy. He came in and I taught him the melody, and he played the melody and the harmony and the chords. And then he was like, is that it? And I was like, that's all I needed. He goes, I want to play some fiddle on it. And so he came and he did tracks of fiddle and all this great stuff. And then I kind of produced it out. Like, I didn't want to have any keyboards on the very heavy keyboard song, right? So I was like, well, how can I do this all with guitars? We had the pedal steel, we had the fiddle, we had electric guitar, acoustic 12 string, baritone guitar, 12 string electric mandolin, which I played for a couple little tidbits in there. And just kind of produced it out that way. And it became a really cool, little piece of music, you know. Wish I wrote it. But
so that's interesting. So that as a track for Spark and Echo, it was more of an afterthought than it was part of the original plan.
It was not part of the plan. Yeah. But it was one of those things where we had been in the studio all day and we were probably kind of burnt. And I was just like, you know what? We're all hanging, feeling good. Let's see what else we can do. And I've always wanted to do a version of that song. So let's do it.
I would imagine that is somewhat of a crowd pleaser when you play that live.
People
recognize it.
We don't play it as much because we used to play it a lot. And so I'm not over it. I'll never get over it. But, you know, so I don't put it in the set list all the time. But I should bring it back in. I get a lot of requests for it.
That's great. That's great. You mentioned the baritone guitar, and that's another thing that I've just come to associate with you and your playing and your creativity. And I've heard you play bass, and I've heard you play baritone guitar. Yeah, I've seen clips of you playing bass.
Holding a bass.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. No, man. I want to scream, stay in your lane, because it sounds so great. But I was wondering, the bass player kind of mentality, is that something that you sort of have naturally? Like, have you been attracted to the bass and that sound, or you know, those frequencies, or is that something that's more novelty? I'm curious how deep you went with that.
Yeah, no pun intended. but I love bass. I think I first picked up a bass in high school. Funny story, I had a band with my buddies in high school. We were probably freshmen or something, and it was just a couple guitar players and a drummer. We didn't have a bass player. You know, likely story, right? But my friend who was the drummer, his dad is like a master woodworker. And so they were like, well, we'll just build a bass. And then I don't know when you guys can figure out how to play it. So they built a bass, like a Warmoth kit bass or something. And so we had a bass, we just didn't have a bass player. So my friend and I would just sort of trade off playing bass in our rehearsals until we found a friend that could actually play bass. So I started fooling around with it, you know, at 14. But I've always loved the sound of it. I love how you can kind of really paint an arrangement and kind of drive the car of the song with the bass line. And so a lot of my big influences are bass players. And when the baritone thing came into perspective, it was kind of the best of both worlds, because the way I play it, at least most of the time when I do sort of the more syncopated groove kind of music on it, it has the snap and the attack of a guitar, but you kind of get into that thump, that range of the bass, which makes it a challenge compositionally, because obviously you want to leave room for the bass, you know, in your song. But it's a cool texture. It's a fun one to explore, and I'm enjoying seeing where it's taking me.
Yeah, that is great. Are there any stringed instruments that you, I know you play a lot of them, but are there any that you really aspire to play or want to develop?
I'm still trying to work on guitar. But it would be, speaking of pedal steel, it would be really fun to have one of those lying around. And, you know, I'm so envious of you guys out in Nashville, these players that, you know, like a Milo that can play anything with strings. You know, they get called in to be the utility string guy or girl, and they just play all the things. But, you know, I would be cool to maybe dabble in mandolin or something, but yeah. I'm a guitar player. That's kind of what makes sense.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. Have you ever played lap steel before?
No, I've played dobro before.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like you're in a studio and it's like, well, what do we need? What can we put on this? I don't know. I got, you know, a hand. I'll make a dobro noise here, you know? So But that's I mean, I play, you know, I think I did one session on a ukulele at one point.
Yeah.
Because thankfully it was the four chords that I knew. But, you know, I'm a guitarist.
That's awesome. Most of the people who know of you, they maybe first found out about you through Snarky Puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that band has had tremendous success. How many years now has that band been together?
They technically started in 2004, so almost 20 years. Yeah, I started working with them mostly around 2009.
Okay.
Yeah,
2009. So did that band, you have your own band, obviously. Mm-hmm. So do you feel like your Snarky Puppy experience and exposure, is that word exposure? do you feel like that served as sort of a help with the momentum of getting your band going, or was that a completely different and separate pursuit?
No, well, it was a separate pursuit, separate but related and joined kind. I mean, I would be doing my own thing regardless, but having the added platform that Snarky Puppy provided, obviously, of course, helped. You know, and now that, you know, I've been kind of pursuing my solo thing pretty intently for the last couple of years, it's found its own world and its own niche, and people are finding out about Snarky Puppy because of Mark Lethierry, which I always think is pretty cool and different. So that's really neat. But you know, I owe a lot to that band, you know, just for helping shape me as a player and a writer and band member and band leader and all that. So yeah, I'm very grateful that, you know, it sometimes says Mark Lethierry of Snarky Puppy, because I get it. Snarky Puppy is a much bigger band than Mark Lethierry, you know.
At this point in your career, do you feel like your main passion is your band? Is it hard to pin down because you get to do so many great things? Or
sure. Yeah, it is hard to pin down, you know, because I think we're all sort of beholden to the element of time. And, if I were to take a year, 2 years, 3 years off of Snarky Puppy and just do the Mark Lethierry stuff, you know, who knows what could happen? Something amazing might happen, or it might go nowhere, you know? So I just have to kind of make sure that I'm devoting the time needed to the things that I want to see grow the way that I want them to grow. And, I'm very spoiled in a sense, and just kind of generally blessed to be able to play the kind of music that I do with the people that I play, like musicians like yourself, you know, doing stuff I like with people I care about. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's the Mark Lethierry group or Snarky Puppy or Fearless Flyers or you and I playing with Dominic or whatever the gig is, you know, I think everything's worked out in its own unique way that I can, you know, now that I'm almost getting to be 40, like make a living doing stuff I like with people I care about. That's really what I did. That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's great.
I got stopped at the zoo today. That was cool. Yeah.
By an animal or a person?
A person.
So, oh, great.
You know, yeah. So, hey, you're Mark Lethierry, you know, that kind of thing. So it's every now and then, that's great. But that's not, you know, I don't go to the zoo hoping someone will recognize, you know, chasing that.
Well, maybe you will now.
I heard about him on the podcast. He sounds like a jerk.
Oh, man. So I got to ask, because this is something I think about all the time. I get into conversations with fellow musicians all the time about this. What do you feel is if you're going to take the temperature of the music industry now, sort of in this post lockdown, you know, era, do you feel like we're still playing catch up to what was before? Do you feel like the game has changed as a result? And
you mean, we have to just hard kind of questions adjust. Here.
I know, man.
Hardball.
Because I don't have the answers. So
yeah, well,
I love talking to people about this.
Man, well, you know, that was the pandemic. Just put the brakes on everybody. you know, it kind of reset everyone to zero. And of course, everyone's position of zero was different, right? Because we all have different careers and lives and things like that. And so we all had to individually figure out a way to get back to where we needed to be, regardless of what our peers maybe thought we should do or what was working for them. Or, you know, I struggled a lot comparing myself, you know, during that period of time, because I was like, I have nothing, but I see these other people and it looks like they have all these things that are still going on. How are they doing that? We're supposed to, you know, I don't have any gigs. How do they have gigs? How are they making records? I don't, you know, but that's just my own kind of ego and personality that we all, or that I struggle with at least, but.
Oh, I think that's common.
But you know, so I just kind of had to, it was almost like, just keep going, you know, a little bit at a time, get back to being passionate about this again. And wanting to do it. And once I kind of made the mental shift that I was still excited about music, the ship kind of started to right itself a little bit.
But I
think we're all kind of playing catch up because a lot, you know, everyone's momentum was stopped. But that, all that to say, it's like, would I be, you know, I don't know how to quantify that. It's like where I was in January of 2020 versus January of 2023. Like, had there not been a pandemic, would I have like 94 Grammys and a Corvette? I don't know. Probably not. You know, you know what I mean? So it happened and I can't change it.
Yeah.
You know, it sucks. It sucked for everybody.
Yeah.
I think it is nice to be able to play shows again. Obviously that's back to normal and everybody's getting in, you know, and in a room together and playing music and seeing shows. I think it's one of those things where, cause yeah, I put out a record in April of 2021. So I had to wait several months before I played a show, you know? So it was just like, I was just every day making social media videos and like doing that machine. Right. And it, you know, burns you out.
But
I think all this to say, I'm glad I did it. And it's sort of a moment in time that is what it is. And, you know, I think the biggest bummer for me is just like, it's just the time thing, you know, like there are things that I wanted to have accomplished, but had to wait. And so now I'm doing them now with a 6-year-old instead of a 4-year-old, for example, which brings a whole other set of challenges and, you know, life just moves forward and you have to just kind of accommodate it, as you best see fit, you know?
So how do you strike your balance then between, You've got snarky dates. You've got dates with your band. I'm pretty sure Fearless Flyers does dates on. Don't you guys do dates on semi-regular, non-regularly?
Really. We don't play that much. Yeah.
How do you slice up your weeks or your months or your days to feel like you are not ignoring something that needs to be nurtured, for lack of a better description?
I just don't overextend myself anymore. You know. And I used to a lot, like, and that was dangerous. but now, you know, I've really understood kind of my limits as far as how long I want to be away from home and what that means and making sure that I'm still dedicating, like I said, the time needed for each thing to blossom the way it's supposed to go. And I like to do things in advance. I like knowing what I'm doing next fall. If I have the luxury of being knowing that there's things that are going on that far, but this sounds funny, but like I open up my iCal and I look and I'm like, okay, there's enough blank days to where I'm not going crazy, but I'm not going to be broke, you know? You know, so I can kind of, I'll find something to do if I'm off, quote unquote, you know, you know how it is as musicians, we're never really off.
Right.
You know, if you have spare time, you're like, well, shoot, I could practice, write a song, or I could just diggle with this pedal that I just got or whatever. You know, there's always something to be doing. And so I always keep that in the back of my mind. And if I do, then I'm never not busy.
Do you teach guitar lessons when you're home?
Not anymore. I did. I taught a bajillion of them over the pandemic. And before that, I used to teach on Skype quite a bit. But again, man, it's time. You know, and for me now, you know, a time when I, you know, in the afternoons, I would teach a Skype lessons or something like that. Now in 2023, I would rather write songs, you know, or practice or do something like that. And, I get requests for lessons all the time. So thank you folks for still caring about that kind of thing. But, you know, I do the video courses. I've put together a couple of those, and those are really fun. And I think people get a lot of, out of those, maybe sometimes even more than they would from a Skype lesson, to be honest. Those can be pretty limiting. They can be cool and they can be inspiring, and there's definitely been some really cool ones, but man, if you're not playing in a room with someone, it's hard.
Yeah.
You know? And I can't teach in person. And then, you know, the whole thing, simply because it's like, I'm, you know, if I'm not home, what are they going to, you know, it's hard to keep a schedule because I am primarily a touring recording session player.
Right? Yeah.
So
do you think it's odd that we're living in a time now where social media has bred professional musicians, and I'm putting quotes, not to be demeaning, but because I'm not sure how to categorize them, but there are players and people that are making some decent money as influencers, as musicians online, who don't really ever play with other musicians. They're doing solo performances through social media. Does that seem weird to you or odd?
It's only weird if what I'm seeing is not real.
That's an interesting way to say it. Yeah.
Like, and it, just going further, you know, everyone can make their art however they want to make it, but I prefer to have the option of knowing you can actually play that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough because it's very easy to edit and splice and dice and quantize and tune. And, you know, we all do it. We all nip and tuck here and there.
Sure.
But, you know, I want to hear you play with just the camera mic. You know, it doesn't have to be a gig. I know a lot of people don't gig, and that's fine. But, you know, show me what you can do in real time, you know? But beyond that, like, if your thing is that, and it's sort of compartmentalized and spliced and diced, and that's art too. You know, I'm not really allowed to have an opinion about that because it's so subjective. There's no objectivity there. I just kind of know personally what I prefer. But if you don't care about what I think, then don't worry about it. but you know, as terms of like the sort of like gear influencer type thing, I think that's great. You know, I'm the dumbass that has to get in a van and drive around. You know what I mean? Like, I'm the idiot that's making Instagram flyers and being like, please come to my gig, you know?
Yeah. More power to you if you don't have to eat out of gas stations.
You know what? So. Yeah. Racetrack hot dogs, man. That's
you on fire. Hey, don't knock them till you try them, people.
I have.
I have too.
but, you know, I mean, I have a lot of friends that are quote unquote, like, you know, the sort of YouTube and social media guitar influencers, and like, I think what they're doing is great. If they're bringing people joy and inspiring them to do stuff, like, I think that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I always feel awkward.
As long as it's real, that's my thing. I just want, you know, I want an element of reality in there if I can.
Are you the kind of person that, how do I ask this? I'll use my own, I'll be transparent. Like, one of the things that I really struggled with coming up as a player was I was basing so much of, you know, like my own self-worth on whether or not what I was playing was getting validation and paying more attention to what other people, you know, thought. And it took many, many years to kind of grow through that. But at the same time, there were humbling moments that I actually learned from. But would you say you're the kind of player that just, you're just not really fazed by those types of things, or are you in touch with people's perception? Because everybody's a little bit different.
I mean, I like to think that I am, but I don't put a ton of weight on it. Because I think if I put I think awareness is important.
That's good.
But reliance is not. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I've definitely put out some things and been aware of some issues that people had with those things. And in some cases they were maybe right, you know, but had I relied on that feedback, you know, or should I say defined my choices permanently by all of that feedback, I probably wouldn't do anything ever again. You know, and so you kind of have to kind of pick and choose the criticisms, I think, because sometimes it is valid and other times it's not. And you know, the ones that are bullshit.
Yeah.
You know the ones that are right, you know, or have some truth to them, have some truth to them to where you can take it and grow and not change what really alter what you're doing in a drastic sense, just sort of like slightly fine tune stuff. And that's why we have the friends who tell us like, hey, yeah, the kick drum was kind of loud, you know, yeah. Or so, you know, something like that. Right. Because if you just worried about what people think all the time and you rely on that, then you get in tune to the trolls and the people that are just pissed because you're doing it and they're not.
Right. Right. I call them the arm folders.
There you go. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I like that. You know,
they stand in front of you at the gig watching you. I can do that better.
Right. You know? But those are the ones that usually cut the deepest, right? And the ones that you like, you know, that bother you for the rest of the day kind of thing. And, you know, I try not to dwell on that kind of stuff if I really know it in my heart to be bullshit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's good. Tell us about your guitars. You've got a great relationship now with
lineup there. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about your signature guitars in particular.
Yeah, sure. It's with Paul Reed Smith and it's called the Fiore, which is Italian for flower. And the name came up because we had got the first prototype and my daughter said that it looked like a flower and we needed a name. And I was thinking of something in Italian and Fiore just sounds really cool. But then it kind of became this metaphor for like blossoming of sound and tone and creation.
Nice. You
know, the ad guy buzzwords in my head were starting to go off, you know, but it's a really dope instrument. Kind of a quote unquote super strat, as they like to say, but yeah, single humbucker, ash body, maple neck, 10 inch radius. It's got a really cool tremolo on it. We voiced the pickups specifically for the guitar. So they all work really well together. It's got a kind of a funky switching system. So you can get like 11 different pickup combinations out of it.
Wow. And
it'll sound cool. Yeah. It comes in four colors currently. And I'm really stoked to see where it goes. It's doing exactly what I wanted it to do because I wanted to make a signature guitar that one was going to be my guitar, but two was going to possibly be a lot of other people's guitars. Even if they had no idea who the heck I was.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people that are buying them have no clue.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But it's been, I mean, you know, it's been on stage with Deep Purple, with The Time, with Lizzo.
Fantastic.
With,
wow.
21 Pilots with, it's been in every type of music.
That's amazing.
From metal to hip hop to country. And I was like,
wow, what a testament to the exactly versatility. The
point. Yeah. That's
the incredible
whole point of it. So.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. It's
good on them for helping me make something cool.
Can you talk a little, people love to hear this. And I'm selfishly want to hear it too. You are another one of those players that I would consider to be a tone smith. You know, you really,
thanks.
Yeah, man, you really are dialed in with the sounds, the placement and the style of the sound you use in situations always seems so perfect for it. Talk to us about your approach to that. You can talk about gear if you want, or just philosophy, but
sure.
We'd love to kind of get inside your head about where this tone inspiration comes from.
Man, I mean, you know, as a creative person, we all kind of have that sound in our head that we're kind of constantly refining, or as Eddie Van Halen would put it, chasing, right? He calls himself tone chaser, which I think that's the greatest term. So I can't take that. I am a student of guitar sounds for the most part, just because I've listened to a million records and studied the sounds of a lot of my favorite, not just guitar players, but session guitar players. Like I love all the artists, you know, and I'm influenced by them and how they get their sounds, but I'm also influenced a lot by how studio players get a lot of their sounds. And so I kind of combine the two things to do what I do, because really I just need the best sound for the song, you know? And sometimes that might be something unfamiliar, or sometimes it's, you know, a very obvious choice. But, you know, as many pedals and things that I have, I always kind of gravitate towards the same kind of sound, I guess. But I am familiar with lots of different sounds if I need to get them in a studio session or something like that. But I wouldn't say I'm like a effects heavy kind of tweaker kind of player. I wouldn't say that at all. I tend to use effects as like seasoning in a meal, but never really something that would dominate an entire plate of food. If that makes sense, to use another food metaphor. Maybe I'm hungry. But, you know, yeah, I have like, I guess I don't really have that many sounds when I'm doing my stuff. Like, you know, because it's so many times in my professional career, there's been situations where like my pedal board dies, or like I don't, you know, or the one spot breaks and I don't have any, and all I have is a one distortion pedal or one, and I have to do the whole gig. And so I always maybe mentally reduce everything down to that. And if I can get the point across with that, then all the rest of the stuff is just fun toys to step on.
So what's the desert island minimum assembly of devices that you rely on?
Man, probably a guitar, an amp with some verb, and then some kind of gain pedal. That's what I grew up playing with. You know, I grew up with a Fender Squire Stratocaster and that Crate amp that's still...
That's awesome.
Which is a 15 watt solid state Crate GX15 with reverb.
This is so weird because I still have my first amp, my Crate B10 or whatever it is.
It's probably look just like that too.
It does. It looks just like that. So that's another thing that is funny we have in common. But yeah, I get it. That's great.
Yeah.
That thing has never stopped working, and I don't understand. It's been in storage in horrific conditions when we've moved, and I don't know. That takes a licking.
Yeah, man.
Keeps on ticking.
They had some stuff, man. They were building some stuff.
Yeah. So with that in mind, then are you a person that ever uses something like a Kemper or anything like that? Have you experimented with those?
Yeah, I have one sitting right here. I use them all the time. Yeah. I use the Kempers all the time. Cause they're easy. And they sound great, you know?
Yeah. Do you think we've gotten to the place where the modeling is as good as, like, you can't, if you A-B, you can't tell the difference? You feel like we've gotten there yet?
I mean, it's pretty close. And it's definitely one of those things where, depending on the kind of song and the mix that it is, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Well, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, but again, it depends on the song. Like, if I'm doing a trio, for example, live in a room, I'm going to want an amp, you know, I want to hear the walls and all that kind of stuff. Kemper, you're not going to really get that, but on a pop session, a rock session where there's overdubs, of course, Kemper's going to be fine, you know? and so, you know, it's a little bit, some players think there's like a feel difference, and I think there kind of is, but it's really close, man. Now that's, I'm talking strictly in recording. On a live session, or a live gig rather, on a stage, I need an amp.
Yeah.
Like, cause I don't use in ears. I just wear earplugs, but I need to fill the cabinet. I need all that stuff if I can, you know. I get it that some gigs you just can't have amps, and fine. If that's the case, I'll use a Kemper. No big deal. But, if you come see the Mark Lethierry group there, I will not have a Kemper on stage. It's not going to happen. So, but I mean, they've got some great plugins now too, that you can just download on your computer.
Yeah.
And I try to get familiar with all that stuff because it all kind of has its place. Mm-hmm. And you know, professionally, I don't want to be in a situation where someone's like, oh, you have to use this. And you're just like, oh, I don't know how to, what am I, I don't want to be in that situation.
Yeah.
So
it's incredible how much the whole plug-in thing has changed how we process and produce music.
I don't think it'll ever replace a real amp because you can't. It physically cannot do it,
but
it will definitely, it's definitely side by side. And now I think for many players, it's just like whichever one you prefer, as long as the results sound good and I can mix it in a tune and it's killing, you know. I mean, the baritone sessions are all Kemper or plugins. There's not a single real, aside from the acoustic guitar on one song, it's all digital.
Wow.
But it fits the mu- but it works for that kind of music.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever. Hmm.
So totally changing gears here. Could you share a story, like one of the funniest or most ridiculous stories from your touring?
Oh man. I told the story. I told this story at the Woodshed Guitar Experience. So if you were there and you heard it and you're listening to this podcast, you get to hear it. It's sort of it's a story, but it's also just kind of a general experience that hopefully will make you laugh. this is maybe 2016, I think it was. Snarky Puppy went on this trip called the Jam Cruise. And the Jam Cruise is a cruise ship that is like a floating concert, floating music festival for a week in the Gulf of Mexico. And they call it the Jam Cruise because a lot of the bands are from the jam band scene. You know, so you got these cool funk, groove, jam, jazz, electronic bands doing their thing. But there's also kind of a bit of a substance culture that goes along with the boat. And I do not partake in the substance culture, but if you do, totally fine. As long as you do it safe, whatever. But anyway, so throughout the trip, there's like a cruise director guy that comes on the intercom to kind of announce the day's events and which band is playing where, et cetera. And he was kind of a slow talking, like kind of hippie guy, like, yeah, man, you know. and on the night we were pulling into the port in Miami after the whole trip had finished, we're on our way back. He gets on the intercom and he goes, "Okay, Jam Cruisers, well, you noticed we were pretty lax with you guys bringing in your goodies on board, you know, at the port, but getting off the boat when we disembark, it's going to be a bit of a different story with the Miami Border Patrol, you know, man." Which was basically code for everyone take all your drugs immediately at once. And so the entire boat just skyrocketed to Venus.
Oh, and my God.
It was pandemonium. People were wearing costumes and dressed like aliens and furry costumes and naked. And just, it was just like,
oh, wow.
You know, I'm in my room, like in the fetal position crying or whatever. And rumor has it some guy jumped off the boat.
Oh, my gosh.
And that his words were, "This ship cannot contain me." And I guess he didn't die or whatever, but apparently the Miami Port Patrol picked him up and arrested him. And then so we landed in Miami and everyone was like, wow, that was a very interesting week. And then we immediately went and played a gig at this club in Boca Raton, only to find out that about 80% of the band had like dysentery from drinking the water on the beach in one of the ports. And so it was one of those gigs where like we all looked green. And then, like, in certain songs, when people weren't playing much, they would sneak off the side of the stage into the green room to do their business and come back, pick up their guitar, goodness. And keep playing the song.
What a nightmare.
Jam Cruise. And then we did it again the following year.
Yeah. Good.
Wow. Yeah, I did it with the Fearless Flyers, too. It's wild. It's a wild. The music is amazing. It. Yeah, they always get really great bands. Get rid of your snacks, everybody.
Oh my gosh, it's an interesting culture. I toured with a jam band once with T. Labbitt's, Jimmy Herring.
Oh wow!
And good grief, drummer for Little Feet, Richie Hayward.
Wow!
And it was called the Justice League. And I had never been on a tour before where so many people would just want to gift you substances, to use your term. They would be insulted if you wouldn't take their substances from them. So me, like yourself, not being a real partaker, I gave them to the members that were, and
there you go.
And so they had,
you don't want to waste it, you know.
No, wasting it is bad.
Wasting is bad.
but they had quite a large bounty full over the course of several weeks. But that's an interesting thing, and that's how they tell. I guess that's how they show you love. It's one of the ways. And
yeah, I mean that's the
God bless them.
The jam scene is one of the tightest, most supportive communities you know,
incredibly loyal
and very much
following. So. It's really amazing.
Yep.
So some people have had some wonderful lucrative careers too.
Sure.
In that world.
Yeah. Anytime we can cross over and do a jam festival, I love doing them.
Yeah.
That's really fun. Cause I mean, you know, even with the Lateri group, which kind of is sometimes a little rock and roll muso, you don't really know what people are like. The jam folks get down to anything.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's really
That's
cool.
So great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I want to bring it to a close, but
cool, man.
Can you tell us how the best way for people to check you out, consume your music, support you.
Yeah.
You mentioned those video classes, anything you'd like to share with us?
Man, if you go, there's two places. You can go to marklateri.com. Yes, I still keep a website, but it is very comprehensive. There's links to all those courses you're talking about. There's links to every record I've made under my own name. There's a link to a Spotify playlist of a bunch of sessions of people's stuff I've played on, if you're interested in that. There's a little bit of info about my gear, and there's tour dates. So if you want to see me play with my band or with Snarky Puppy or Flyers or whoever, it's going to be on there. So
awesome.
Just go to marklateri.com. And then I'm on all the socials. I don't tweet or X, whatever
you don't X.
It's called. No, I have a Twitter or an X or whatever that is, but yeah, I don't really use
it. I'm still not used to it being X.
Yeah, whatever.
So, yeah. Man, this has been so much fun. Thank you.
Yeah,
again
my pleasure, man.
Taking the time. And man, I can't wait to connect again with you musically. So
yeah,
hopefully
dude,
that'll be
will.
Soon.
I'm sure.
So, all right.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Go out and please support this fine gentleman and purchase his music, buy tickets to go see him. Do all you can. Go to his website, and we appreciate you all. And we will catch you on the next episode. God bless.
Peace.